Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Professor Mark Banks from the University of Leicester about his new book, Creative Justice, Cultural Industries, Work and Inequality, which is published by Roman and Littlefield in 2017. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Professor Mark Banks from the University of Leicester about his new book, Creative Justice, Cultural Industries, Work and Inequality, which is published by Roman and Littlefield. So welcome to the pod.
Thanks, Dave.
It's great to have you on to talk about this book, which I think is a really kind of important and very, very timely book. And it'd be interesting, I think, to kick off with a sense of where this book has come from and where it sort of fits in to the work you've been doing more broadly on cultural creative industries. So I wonder if you could say a bit about the sort of the gestation of the book and where it fits into your broader academic agenda.
Yeah, sure. Well, I've been thinking about it for a few years, maybe 3 or 4 years, thinking about wanting to write a book of this kind. And it took me a couple of years of mulling it over, and then a couple of years of actually writing it. And I suppose in some ways it's a follow-up to a previous book I wrote called The Politics of Cultural Work, which came out about 10 years ago, which is really a kind of synthetic work, really, setting out what seemed to me an emerging field around cultural industries and cultural work and people doing more research on work and employment in that kind of sector. And a few years on, it's becoming clear that many other people have become interested in this field as well, and the amount of studies and research projects that were being undertaken around the cultural industries and around work and employment within them was expanding quite rapidly. And it seemed to me that we were generating all this kind of really interesting data. New arguments were coming into the field. It's been a really exciting time, I think, the last decade or so in the kind of area that I'm working in. So the idea for Creative Justice came out of, I suppose, a bit of a taking stock of where we are in the field in terms of what we know around conditions of work and employment in culture. And I wanted to think a bit about where we were in terms of the field as a whole and how people were thinking about issues around equality and equity and participation in the cultural industries, which would seem to be becoming more prominent and more controversial in many kinds of ways. And partly, I think, I was also motivated by a desire to try and suggest a kind of a more normative vocabulary for what we were writing about and thinking about in terms of the cultural sector. I wanted us to think a bit more about those kind of issues around justice and what all this kind of really rich and interesting data that people were generating was leading to, where it was taking us politically, and what might help us, if you like, activate or encourage or develop a more of a kind of a justice agenda, I suppose, within this field of work, which was clearly riddled with many kinds of problems.
What are we actually talking about then when we kind of use this idea of creative justice? What I guess is the kind of the meaning of this term, and where does it map onto that landscape you've just outlined?
Yeah, I think I'm still working it out to some degree. It's a kind of it's intended as a kind of a provocative term in many ways. It's a term that's coined, I suppose, to try and get people to think about, most simply, I suppose, social justice issues in the courtroom industry. So it's a term really that's designed to invite speculation, really, on issues of equality and equity in the cultural sector. So I'm really thinking of it as a provocation or an invitation to others, really, as much as a fully formed concept or argument. But in the book, of course, I do try to develop some idea of what it might mean, or mean at least to me. So in the book, I make a case for thinking about justice in terms of what I call giving and receiving, giving consideration, respect and due to culture, but also about people receiving fair treatment, fair appraisal and just rewards in respect of culture. And the book kind of hangs on this dual hook or riff on the nature of justice. So in terms of the giving aspect, the first kind of justice I try to give is to culture itself, where I say that it's important to pay respect and do justice to culture, which I would say involves trying to take it seriously on its own terms. Now, this is not in any kind of romanticist, idealist, perfectionist sense, but in the sense of trying to trying to understand really what kind of entity culture actually is, and more specifically, what kinds of objects are being produced by people in the cultural industries. What are they? What is it that we're dealing with when we're dealing with cultural goods? And secondly, in terms of giving, I try to think about how justice might be given to cultural work in itself, you know, the act, the task of producing cultural goods. So to me, this is something like considering its fullest qualities. So giving it its due, considering holistically what kind of activity cultural work actually is. So of course, this involves understanding it both as a source of pleasures and meanings and sources of pride and fulfillment and creative satisfaction and so on, all those things that are often positively attached to working in culture, but also thinking about those activities in terms of various external structures and pressures that bear down on the profit motive, the search for awards and social statuses and so on. And also thinking about those qualities of cultural work that are often less than appealing and often deeply problematic. And of course, we know what those are: alienation, exploitation, dispossession, and so on. So doing justice to cultural work means thinking about, if you like, both sides of it, the good and the bad, the things that people gain from it on a personal and social level, but also the kind of relations that people are kind of entered into when they're in the capitalist workplace. So that's the first half of the book is really about that giving of justice, doing justice to cultural objects, but doing justice to cultural work. But in terms of the receiving part of the binary, if you like, the second half of the book really goes on to talk about how different institutions like firms and schools and universities and so on allocate or distribute their resources in more or less fair or equal ways. And this is a more traditional concern with issues around distributive justice. So thinking about who gets the best kinds of cultural education, who is gets the highest pay or indeed any kind of pay, who gets the best or indeed any kind of cultural industry job. So this, of course, as you know, from your own work, is the topic very much of the moment. So I guess, you know, to summarise, I suppose, creative justice for me is about those issues of giving and receiving. How can we better understand and appreciate what the cultural industries are, what they produce, and how they're produced, but also appreciating how people do or don't receive their fair distribution of all the opportunities and rewards and statuses that cultural work can occasion.
I mean, we'll sort of unpack them a bit more, I think. And a good way to start is that idea you mentioned about giving kind of value and doing justice to cultural objects. And you talk early on in the book, sort of in the introduction, the first substantive chapter, about the kind of sociological moment of thinking about cultural objects being insufficient or having given rise to a bit of a kind of a crisis around how we understand cultural value. So I wonder if you could sort of talk through that sense of how you do justice to a cultural object, and indeed kind of why it's necessary to do that justice.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky one. And I think most I suppose conventional sociology has tends to shy away from that question a bit of doing justice to cultural objects and see it as quite a kind of problematic question. But I suppose what I suggest in the book that doing justice to cultural objects means, as I was saying earlier, it means treating them on their own terms and evaluating them according to their own qualities, and not just understanding them in terms of the ways in which they are subjectively valued or apprehended or consumed as they tend to be viewed in most kind of mainstream sociology. So we do need to think, of course, of objects as having that social provenance, and our tastes for objects as being partly inherited and shaped by social background, shared interests, and so on, as you know, as Bourdieu and you know, others have argued. But I also make the argument in the book that we need to recognise, I suppose, that that's not all there is to say about the value of cultured objects. And in the book, I make the case for a more qualified valuing of culture, I suppose, that takes into account both those subjective apprehensions and those patterns of taste as a source of value, but also considers what I call the objective qualities of cultural goods themselves, and objective, their meaning in the sense of pertaining to objects, their actual properties, what kind of entities they actually are. So it's a kind of a realist take on the culture of objects. And I think, to me, this has kind of some distinctive components. The first is thinking about the structures and properties of cultured objects themselves. And the example I use in the book is, you know, my own taste for David Bowie's music, which is partly able to be explained sociologically, of course. So someone of my age and ethnicity and class background and so on might well be more predisposed to like David Bowie's music, just like many thousands of others who share a similar kind of habitus to me. But such taste, I suppose, is not able to be fully explained in those terms, simply because I think a lot of conventional sociological accounts are just not very good at making sense of everything. So this includes, to me, the objective structures of music, which I take to mean their material, kind of sonic attributes, and their aesthetic codes, which are properties that partly exist outside of those kind of discourses we use to understand them. And nor, I think, can it count for the full qualities of the experiences that take place when, a David Bowie musical object encounters a listener like me. Because these experiences are not wholly given or sociologically predictable in a closed way, but are also kind of partly emergent. And I suppose, finally, also, I think, nor can conventional sociology, as it currently stands, very well account for how musical taste is not just a social construction, not just defined by class background or habitus, but might well speak to some, if you like, trans-contextual or objective human needs, such as, for care, for sociability, for recognition and so on, that might relate to various kinds of lack or want, and they're not really only socially determined, but also, you could say, essential parts of our kind of human psyche. And I think cultural sociology, especially that's been inspired by Bourdieu, great though it is and valuable though it is and how much we need it, just isn't able to get much of a handle on those other kinds of qualities. And if you read the work of Janet Wolfe, her recent book, The Aesthetics of Uncertainty, Georgina Bourne's work on BBC and Erkam as well, we get a similar kind of sense of trying to give a less reductive, but still sociological account of the object in its context. And writers like Antoine Ennion have kind of also emphasized how objects have their own qualities and attributes that might be independent of the sociological gaze that's brought to them. And so valuation in those terms, I think, has been quite influential on the way I've approached valuation, or the theory of valuation in my own book. And I've been looking at how we need to not just think about the subjective apprehension of cultural objects and how, they're inherited, shaped by habitus, and partly kind of constructed within that vein, but also how they have dimensions of objective quality. That's partly about the kind of objects that they are in themselves. And I think that's what I mean by doing justice to cultural objects, taking those both those subjective and objective dimensions and looking at them more in a more holistic way, I suppose.
The kind of flip side to that, I guess, kind of holistic look at the object is looking at the producing, looking at work. And just as you're kind of theoretically engaged with the limitations of Budgesian sociology. You introduce another theoretical construction to help us think about production and work, which is this idea of moral economy. And, you know, you talked about the kind of we're well served, I guess, in terms of thinking about cultural work. But moral economy struck me as something that was, you know, quite a useful new or maybe old but applied new framework. So I wonder if you could say a bit about that, about moral economy and doing justice to the practice of cultural work.
Yeah, I've always found it a really kind of stimulating concept. I've been thinking about it a while. Of course, in social science, I suppose, the kind of social science we're familiar with, writers like Andrew Sayer have been most prominent in thinking about developing that concept. So I've been inspired by that, really. But the way I use it in my book and my other work, really, in its simplest form, is to think about how moral economy simply refers to the ways in which economic values and principles combine with, or more often tend to override, non-economic values and interests. And in the context of cultural work, I use it really to think about the ways in which cultural work contains different and competing ethics and articulations of value. So firms, managers and artists and others invest their work with varied purposes, intentions and meanings, which have a kind of an ethical or kind of moral dimension to them, as much as they're about kind of instrumental gain or profit making or the conventional, you know, ambitions of capitalist work. And I think moral economy is a way of getting into some of the more complex motivations and practices that people are engaged in when they're embedded in, you know, the context of cultural work production. And in the book, I use the particular example of professional working music to try and reveal how cultural work is understandable as a kind of moral or ethical endeavour in a complex way, driven by, you know, different norms and values and interests. And I use a particular understanding of the concept of practice, which is drawn from Alistair McIntyre, a kind of neo-Aristotelian philosopher. McIntyre's concept of practice helps really to show how work is driven by different internal and external goods and rewards. So internal desires for community, creative expression, particular kinds of sociability and skills and human flourishing, while at the same time it's also directed and driven by what he calls external desires or external goods, which are much more about kind of wealth, profit, money-making, but also things like social status and esteem and so on. So a moral economy approach, I think, is really good at getting at both those, if you like, internal, native, kind of intrinsic reasons why people love their creative work, which is what we know they do, as well as exposing the kinds of sacrificial, precarious labour, inequalities and injustices and so on that mark out the cultural workplace. But it's also really good at getting a handle on those kind of external rewards and those external processes and drivers that make work often less than equal and less than just. So the case of music really is just used to illuminate a wider point about cultural work and about moral economy, that doing justice to cultural work, if you like, not only involves that empirical work of describing and detailing what work is, it also demands a certain amount of normative judgment about the qualities of it. Is this work any good? Is this the kind of work we want to encourage? Is this good or bad work in the terms that's used by others in the literature? So thinking about moral economy helps me, at least, to think about contribution that cultural work might or might not be making to well-being or ill-being, I suppose, in capitalist societies.
I mean, you kind of hinted that the book is a sort of book of two halves almost, you know, and that sense of doing justice to objects and workers provides the starting point for a broader engagement with the social structure itself. And one of the ways you do this, building on and developing from the moral economy ideas, is around education. And you pick up on this idea about talent, both the social construction of talent, but also the kind of the patterning of the education system in the way it deals with talent. So maybe you could tell us a bit about how talent is socially constructed, and at the same time, the education system seems to kind of reinforce the inequalities related to that social construction.
Yeah, I think, you know, talent is a really interesting concept. It's what I've, you know, become more interested in as I've written the book, and, you know, I want to do more work on this, I think. And, you know, historically, this is where Bourdieusian sociology and the sociology of education have also been really revealing, because a lot of the work that's gone on in those, in that kind of field, has really exposed some of the assumptions around, if you like, talent that I criticise in the book. But I suppose one of the first things I would say about talent is that, again, a bit like the cultural object, it does have some kind of objective basis. So we can say that most people are more or less capable of doing something, and that there are certain kind of biological prerequisites or conditions that allow you to have talent. So you need vocal cords so that you can sing. Maybe having kind of nimble fingers allows you to play those musical instruments more effectively, more easily, and so on. But I think the idea that talent is somehow entirely natural, as a lot of people seem to believe, is really kind of way off the mark. And actually, as I argue in the book, this idea is really used to provide a certain amount of ideological cover for what is the more general process of the social sorting and patterning, as you say, and the unequal allocation of opportunities and rewards and jobs in culture. So talent is a kind of alibi that allows discrimination and inequality to occur. I think how that works, really, is in processes of recruitment, in processes of selection, let's say for elite arts academies and so on, people are being excluded, not because they lack talent in an objective sense, not because they're incapable of doing things, but because they don't often convey, like, the right social appearance, the right dress, the right style, manner, linguistic competence, and so on, all those kind of things that Bourdieusians would call dispositions, that would invite people to be designated as talented. And it's been shown time and time again, I think, in the sociology of education, that when it comes to selection for the best jobs or elite academies and so on, the children of the elite get selected. And this is not on the basis, in the cultural sector, of any natural capacity for art that's intrinsic to the middle classes, but because they've been socialised into presenting themselves as talented, and because they do have all the benefits of those social advantages that have been endowed to them through their upbringing. So access to training, best kinds of schooling, routine or more routine exposure to diverse arts, forms and cultural experiences, moneyed parents who can afford to pay for classes and trips and so on. This provides, if you like, the talented with all the resources to cultivate this kind of cosmopolitan or aesthetic disposition. It's highly rated by selectors. And it's well known, of course, as the sociology of education work has told us time and time again, that selectors select in their own image. So I think, as Bourdieu argued quite rightly a long time ago, back in the 70s, talent really can better be understood as what he called a negation of the social conditions of the production of cultivated dispositions. So really, what he's saying is a mask that obscures the social origins of that which is commonly recognised as being essential and natural. And how this kind of plays out in the cultural sector, most obviously, I suppose, is through things like black kids being turned away from music conservatoires because they lack the dispositions and the currencies that allow them to present themselves as talented. Or they play in less tutored, more informal styles that are less valued by elite academies. And a lot of the research that I was involved with around kind of jazz showed that repeatedly. We also see poor kids often unable to get over that hurdle of having to appear erudite and knowledgeable about art at interviews when they apply to fine art schools, or being rejected on the basis that they're, quote, not engaged enough because they're just not able to routinely attend theatres, galleries, and so on, where financial and cultural capital might be required, of course, to facilitate attendance. So all these people are much less likely to be designated as talented because they lack the material and social resources that allow them to cultivate both their objective talent, the things they can do, but also, crucially, their appearance as a talented student. So I think this is part of the problem around the idea of talent, that it's being used as a way of kind of sifting or filtering and patterning the social field in arts education in particular, in ways that are often kind of invisible or certainly much less kind of challenged than they might be. And I suppose the last thing I'll say about the idea of talent is overall I think it's a problematic concept. But nobody, not even those, if you like, who are the victims of all that ideological work and that exclusion and that patterning that goes on that to identify them as being untalented, none of those people really dispute that talent exists, mostly in the form of some kind of innate, individualized kind of natural capacity that simply should be allowed to flourish. So I think that's something we need to think about a bit more and challenge as well. Not least, I think, to expose some of those ingrained ways in which talent is used to filter and sort people socially. We need a kind of new kind of vocabulary around talent, actually, and all those kind of terms that relate to it around meritocracy as well, which are coming to the fore.
I'm glad you mentioned meritocracy. How do we put this discussion of talent into a kind of wider historical context? I mean, the fifth chapter, which deals with the kind of history and questions, meritocracy is the one I was really drawn to. And I guess, that kind of bigger question of like, how do we historicize that discussion of talent, that discussion of meritocracy is the key thing there.
Yeah. I mean, I think that chapter is the one I like as well. It's got a kind of, broader kind of historical focus to it, I think. And, there is, I think I would say a myth that certainly in the UK, during the kind of post-war period, the period of, social democracy, if you like, the second half of the 20th century, that the cultural industries were somehow more meritocratic, more open, and people from ordinary backgrounds were able to kind of elevate themselves up the career ladder within them much more kind of easily. And to some extent, what I show in that chapter is that's kind of true, but it's also something that's debatable in a sense, because not everybody, and certainly not women or ethnic minorities, were able to elevate themselves in quite the same way as people from working class backgrounds. And also, overall, a lot of the kind of top jobs in culture have always been colonized by kind of middle class constituencies. So that chapter really kind of takes people through, I suppose, the late 20th century in Britain and brings it up to the kind of contemporary debate around access to arts and cultural work. So I suppose in the UK, it begins by looking at how in the post-war period, there were employment gains and a more diverse entry, I suppose, into cultural industry occupations. And this is underwritten by capitalist growth, but also by some significant transformations in systems of education and welfare. So after the 1944 Butler Education Act, we see that we have a new national system of free secondary education up to the age of 15, and later 16. And then by the early 60s, a greater number of people from working and lower middle class backgrounds are finding their way into further and higher education, starting to populate universities. And there's a great expansion, as you know, in higher education during the 60s and 70s. And many of the universities at the time were, of course, providing new courses in the fine and applied arts, which were enabling people to enter those kind of expanding professions, which were being created in the moment of their undertaking. So the music industry, broadcasting, television, journalism, so they were hugely expanding. So this has kind of underwritten the idea that, 40 or 50 years ago, the cultural field was much more kind of open, much more diverse, and people were able to kind of elevate themselves through the field on the basis of kind of talent and merit and so on. What that kind of obscures, of course, is that at the time, there were certain people who weren't able to do that. So throughout what is often called, the long boom or the kind of golden age of post-war capitalism, women remained deeply excluded from most kind of cultural professions other than in kind of like supplementary or support or administrative roles. We know that black and ethnic minority people made very little inroads into the cultural industries until maybe the kind of 1980s. But I think the picture is also kind of cloudy as well. And there's actually very little data about recruitment, employment, or patterns of progression within the cultural industries between about 1950 and 2000. And so the idea that's commonly held that working class people somehow took over the arts in the post-war period there was a great equalization, a great kind of meritocratic kind of drive, isn't really able to be borne out by the data, because we don't really have that much data on the one hand. But also, at the same time, the argument I make in the book is that the apparent visibility or the rise of a lot of kind of working class talent, if you think of all those pop stars and film stars in the 60s and 70s, all from working class backgrounds, by and large, all of them went to art schools. They're, if you like, the kind of the front story or the cover story that masks, to me, a more complex narrative underneath, which is about really the establishment of kind of middle class privilege within the arts and cultural sector as they expanded. So the story is actually kind of quite complex. And the today's narrative, you know, you are involved in, I'm involved in, a lot of people are writing about at the moment, is telling us that the cultural interests are profoundly unequal, that certain sections of society are really disadvantaged in respect of them, and somehow this has changed. And to some degree that's kind of true, but I also make the point in the book that actually historically there are certain members of society who have always been excluded from the cultural industries, and the patterns of participation that have unfolded over 50 years are actually kind of quite complex, but also demonstrate as much continuity as change, I think, over time.
The book kind of comes to a close with, I guess, a set of principles, some of which are a kind of call to arms. And it'd be interesting, I think, to finish our discussion on them. But before we do, there's the kind of sticky matter of pay and money. And obviously, you know, one of the things that's really important in this area is money, you know, the kind of possibility of really big rewards, you know, of kind of superstar earnings or wages. But then the reality of low pay, insecurity, precariousness, which you've kind of touched on and talked about a little bit already. And I wonder if you could sort of talk through the idea of sort of the labour process of creative work and the problem of artists getting paid, because I think that's quite a nice, as many other bits of the book do actually, intersection of practical questions about money and then more kind of broader theoretical questions about production processes and labour processes.
Yeah, I mean, it's again, it's a, you know, very much a topic of the moment, isn't it? I kind of guess a lot of researchers now reinforce what was, I suppose, has always been known in a way, that, you know, working in art is low-paid work, and the vast majority of people who work in arts and culture do so on low or subsistence wages, sometimes no wages at all. Free labour, of course, is a big problem in the cultural economy. And that to survive in the cultural sector, usually you need some kind of second job. Most often that's teaching or administration. But actually, you might also be relying on families, partners, spouse, and so on to prop up your participation in the cultural sector. And the idea that people could independently make, if you like, even the average wage or a decent living beyond that in art is really something that's restricted to a minority of participants, as we know. And this is kind of something perhaps we've always known, but equally it's something that's being put forward now more urgently as a political question. I think that, you know, that's a good thing. One of the interesting questions for me is arguments as to why low pay exists. And there are various reasons that have been put forward for it, and I kind of go over them a little bit, I suppose, in the book. And if you're a cultural economist, there are various arguments that you might want to suggest as to why is low pay in the arts, and that often relates to arguments about oversupply, as it's called. So there are too many arts graduates chasing too few jobs, which is why pay is low. There's an argument about speciality or specialism and training. So artists are trained in a sense, but they don't have to be, participate in the artistic economy, and they certainly don't need to be especially trained as other kinds of professionals like engineers and surgeons and so on. So if you like, there's a kind of a low barrier of professional entry, which encourages people to enter the market, which depresses wages. Another reason, I suppose, why pay is regarded to be low, if you're thinking it from an economist perspective, is a kind of high social prestige that's attached to being an artist. But at the same time, it's tied to the idea that artists are producing peripheral, kind of marginal or luxury goods. Compared to neurosurgeons or pilots or something, the artist is often seen to be a kind of like a luxury or an expendable contributor to the economy. And this is another justification of why the pay is low. And I suppose the most familiar reason why we would think the pay is low, or one that crops up in the literature time and time again, is that artists are low paid because they're prepared to be so. And that's tied to all these arguments around kind of sacrificial labor, working for love, working for passion, and deriving the various kinds of, if you like, psychic income, as a cultural economist like David Crosby would call it. But one of the points I make in the book, I suppose, is that while these arguments are kind of more or less true in different ways, what they don't really point to is the issue of inequality. And one of the reasons why artistic pay tends to be low for the majority is to do with inequality. It's to do with inflationary markets for, if you like, the top talent. It's to do with an uneven distribution of incomes and rewards in arts and cultural organisations. Steepening pay pyramids, if you like, whereby, you know, the very best talent, or the very top talent, tend to be over rewarded at the expense of the majority, and, you know, a real kind of growth in inequality between rank and file, pay and reward, the managerial and executive pay that's gone on over the last 10 or 20 years. So the issue of artist pay is not just about, you know, those conventional cultural economist arguments. It's actually to do with inequality, and I think that's something that, certainly in critical social science, people are kind of making as aware of and campaigning against, and providing kind of, you know, various kinds of illuminating research in respect of. But it isn't something that's still part of the mainstream debate, I think, around pay in the artistic sector.
So what do we do? The kind of classic question that comes from these critical moments is you know, what do we do about this? This stuff, these inequalities of pay rates, you know, these assumptions about entry into conservatoires or art schools, you know, these questions about how we value objects. And you set out five principles that cluster around, I think, three areas about objects, participation and harms in the conclusion as a sort of manifesto or a way forward. So can you take me through objects, participation and harms as the principles of creative justice?
The what do we do question, the perennial question. I suppose the first thing I said is that people are already doing a lot, and, you know, in tandem or in parallel with a huge amount of academic literature that's sprung up around cultural work and cultural industries in the last couple of decades, of course, what we're also seeing is a huge amount of kind of political organising, work on in unions and so on. People at the coalface of cultural production organising and agitating for various kinds of justices as they see them. So there's a lot going on, and I think, the book ends with these kind of three, if you like, principles, which are really inspired or grow out of things that I see happening out there already. So they're not entirely abstract or conjured out of thin air, but what I do is try and link them to things that I see concretely going on. But as you say, you know, I kind of suggest these three schematic, kind of provisional concepts, which I really, like I was saying at the start of our discussion, I really see them as being kind of like tools to think with, or kind of provocations or provisional ideas, as a way of kind of taking forward the idea of developing a normative vocabulary around justice and cultural work. But just to think about them in turn a little bit, the first concept I link back to what we were talking about earlier, doing justice to objects, doing justice to work. So the first concept I suggest is this idea of objective respect. And I define that in the book in the following way. Objective respect is to respect cultural objects and practices by evaluating them in terms of their own objective qualities as well as their subjective apprehension value. So respecting culture in this sense means taking seriously the objects of culture, the texts, the goods, symbols and signs that people produce, as being meaningful phenomena with their own objective as well as subjectively experienced properties. So in the way I earlier described, it's about thinking holistically about objects, what they're comprised of, what their properties are, but also how they move and mediate in the social field. that's the first sense of kind of objective respect, thinking about doing justice to the object. But doing justice to cultural work, as I say, means respecting the internal goods and qualities of work as an ethical practice, as I was talking about earlier, but without discounting those external structures and pressures that tend to make work sometimes less than appealing and often deeply unfair and unjust. So objective respect really is just about respecting objects and respecting work. The second concept I suggest is this idea of parity of participation. And this isn't my concept. This is one I've taken from Nancy Fraser. And Nancy Fraser coined this idea of parity of participation, and she defines it in her work as social arrangements that permit all adult members of society to interact with one another as peers. So it's really intended as a way of bringing different kinds of justice under a common measure, which is the degree to which people are able to engage and interact in different spheres of activity as equals, as peers. So it's very much kind of like a recognition of the peer status of people and treating them as kind of human beings of, you know, equivalent kind of moral worth. So I've kind of stolen a bit of Nancy Fraser's idea there on parity of participation, but tried to adapt it to the specificity of the cultural sector. So I kind of suggest that parity of participation really means in the cultural sector that we have to do three things. The first of those is trying to develop social arrangements that allow for the maximum range of people to enter and participate in cultural work, and that's what they want to do, in ways in which they will be fairly treated and justly paid and rewarded for their efforts relative to their peers. So it's about kind of a fair and just economic participation. The second thing I think we should be doing is ensuring that people are not prevented from entering cultural work on the grounds of any unfair cultural discrimination or prejudice, and that people have equal opportunities to participate and develop in cultural work once they become engaged or employed. So that's an argument really about kind of cultural recognition and respect. And thirdly, I think in terms of parity of participation, what we should be looking to do is to try and develop the cultural industries as democratic spaces or democratic arenas where minority and marginal groups can advance their own fair representation and secure a fairer share, if you like, of the public communicative space. One of the kind of underpinnings, if you like, of creative justice is to do with enabling people to participate in culture as a way of engaging in a democratic polity, as a political question. So that's the second concept. And the final concept, as you say, is this idea of what I call reduction of harms. And I kind of define that as reducing the physical and psychological harms and injuries inflicted by cultural work based on an assessment of objective conditions and their effects on human beings. And harm is a kind of slightly elusive concept in a way, but I think of it as, or we can think of it, I suppose, as a condition of physical or psychological ill-being or hurt induced, in this case, by the practice of cultural work. So these might be self-induced or they might be other-induced. It might include exploitation or self-exploitation, things like overworking and stress, intimidation, bullying, domination, aggression, violence, and so on. These are some of the harms we can locate in cultural work, and they stem from various kinds of class, gender, or race-based discrimination, misrecognition. Others might be more personal, indiscriminate, or else derived from some kind of institutional carelessness or indifference. Wherever they come from, though, I think the idea of reduction of harms is an interesting, maybe an important principle, because its activation does suggest the possibility of a positive and complementary effect coming into force, which is an increase in human well-being through flourishing. So flourishing does consist in being able to expand or develop your human powers, your faculties and capacities, which do derive from being able to live well and work well in environments that are safe and sustaining and supportive. So they're kind of the reduction of harms and an increase in flourishing, of course, are kind of quite closely related. And I think that's the third principle I suggest as being one that we might want to consider thinking about supporting, developing as we move forward with a politics of cultural industries and cultural work.
And is that moving forward the kind of the next thing for you? Is that going to be where you're going work-wise, or have you got, you know, sort of a different set of projects and a different set of questions that you want to engage with, maybe with the next book or the next set of papers or the next project?
Yeah, well, I don't know about the next book. I think I'm probably good for a book every decade or so, but certainly thinking, yeah, having, I suppose, suggested a set of concept or a vocabulary of the kind that I have suggested, then I suppose it's incumbent on me to try and think about where that, how that might be developed. I suppose the broader point there, though, is not so much the efficacy or the salience of those concepts in particular. It's more about encouraging, I suppose, a more kind of avowedly kind of normative approach to cultural industries, research and cultural work. You know, I'm kind of interested in people kind of coming up with their own take on creative justice, I suppose, or the idea of justice in the cultural industries. You know, I think we're at that moment where politically there's a great deal of kind of energy, willingness, kind of enthusiasm to challenge some of the kind of structures that have been embedded over 15 years in the, what we call the cultural and creative industries. So I suppose what I'm looking to do is how I would contribute to that kind of process of further politicising and further making normative in various kinds of ways the cultural sector. So that's a kind of a general outcome from the book, I suppose, that I'll be thinking about. What I also have been doing recently is writing a little bit about the history of the idea of the creative city and cultural and industry discourse. I've just written an article with Justin O'Connor. It's coming out in the European Journal of Cultural Studies in the autumn, which is partly about historicising our understanding of the idea of creative cities, which has been very pervasive, as you know, over the last few decades as well. So I suppose what's coming out from that is that I'm becoming much more interested in kind of historical evaluations of the cultural industries and cultural work, discourse and practice. That's something that, you know, I'd quite like to develop further in the future. And apart from that, I'm trying to write a little bit more about music, dance, art schools and those things that I've been writing about most recently with others, you know, such as Kate Oakley and other collaborators as well.
And this is part of the Cameo Centre at Leicester?
Yeah, we've got a new research institute, which I'm part of, which is called Cameo, which stands for Cultural and Media Economies. And it's a group of people drawn from media, communication, sociology, from critical management elements in the School of Business, from English, from geography. We're trying to draw widely from across the disciplines available to create a research institute that's very much focused around issues of social justice and participation and sustainability in cultural, media and creative economies. And that's not only focusing on the kind of work that I'm interested in, but it's also kind of taking a much more kind of broader sweep across the cultural field to think about all kinds of different forms of cultural production and consumption, and how they too might be linked to a kind of a social justice and sustainability agenda. So that's really exciting. So yeah, one of the things I'll be doing is working with my colleagues to try and get that further off the ground.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. I've been your host, Dr. David O'Brien. On this episode, I was talking to Professor Mark Banks about creative justice, cultural industries, work, and inequality.